I can see them like in their late 20s, early 30s, they're already burning out. And I don't want to be one of those people.
Father, husband, world traveler, speaks 9 languages, and did I mention elite coffee aficionado? Matejo Savar is all that, but perhaps most importantly, he's a good friend and someone who I truly respect in this industry. Matej is the co-founder and co-owner of Vigor Ground, a fitness and performance facility in Ljubljana, Slovenia. He's also the head of rehab and consultant for the first team at FC Bravo, a Slovenian first division soccer team, as well as coach to several national team players and a mentor to young coaches. Today, we're going to dive into a handful of big topics, including return to play and KPIs he's using to help drive both that and the training process, how to best use data to drive decision-making, how he's developing both in and off-season programs for his soccer players, the role of the SNC consultant, and how aging strength coaches like ourselves can continue to make their mark while staying fit, healthy, and happy along the way. This is just such a fun episode with Matej, and I know you're going to love it. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll jump right in. Have you heard about the new iFast University? When Bill Hartman and I created iFastU in 2016, we had one primary goal: to make iFast University an elite resource for trainers, coaches, and rehab professionals across the globe. Continuing education is something that we've always taken great pride in here at iFast, and we wanted to create an extension of that with iFastU. Because here's the thing, there are tons of great trainers and coaches out there who legitimately want to learn from us and get better, but don't have the ability to come to iFast and do it in person. So whether you're a young, up-and-coming coach who's just getting started, or a seasoned vet of the training game, if you want to get better each and every month, I'm sure we have an option for you. We now have 2 membership options at iFastU based on your needs and goals: Standard and Elite. Our Standard option is like the Netflix of training Con Ed. Here, you'll have access to the complete iFastU archive, which has well over 100 in-depth videos on topics like program design, coaching, and anatomy and movement. Plus, every month you'll get a new piece of content from a world-class coach, someone that's going to help you take your game to the next level. But if you're really looking to fast-track your progress, you may want to get in on iFastU Elite. Here, you'll not only have access to the archives and monthly content drops like standard users, but you also have direct access to both Bill and I each and every month. Between 2 monthly Q&A calls, access to over 100 previously recorded Q&A calls, and direct access to both of us and our elite group of trainers and coaches via our private forum, this is a surefire way to get around the right people and level up fast. If you're interested in learning more, just head over to iFastUniversity.com. Again, that's iFastUniversity.com. We hope to see you in the U soon. Matej, man, thank you so much for coming back on the show today. Super excited to have you on. Could you start by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. And first of all, I'm honored to be on here and honored to be on here for the third time. So it's a real privilege. I know you've got some really high level guests here, some leaders in the field, and just feel privileged to be a part of this. So thank you. But yeah, about myself, I'm a strength and conditioning coach from Ljubljana, Slovenia. I'm a joint founder and owner of Vigor Ground Fitness Performance here in Slovenia. My brother Luca, who some of your listeners might know, is the owner of Vigor Ground facility in Seattle in the States. What can I say in terms of education? I've finished my master's in strength and conditioning at Mary's University, Twickenham in London. And I've mostly been involved in football or soccer for you guys on the other side of the pond. So Vigor Ground is actually going into its 18th year. So it'll be pretty much, it's an adult entity, in at least in Europe. We're missing a few years in terms of the States. But yeah, and I've pretty much been working with football players the entire time because I was a player myself. I was decent when I was growing up. I went through levels, came up to international level at under 17, and then also England University's team and so forth. Played a bit of a semi-pro, just touched the pros a little bit as well. But at the end, it wasn't to be. And then I just moved into what I felt was the logical progression. I really love training. Myself and Luca, we both love training, and we were looking for something that would give us an environment and give others an environment to train like athletes, even though we weren't essentially looking to train athletes. And like everyone, we started out with Gen Pop, and soon, quite soon, former teammates were coming across and asking me to train them. And yeah, it evolved pretty organically. Obviously, that's summing it up little bit. But yeah, now these days, I'm working as one of the lead educators on the UEFA football fitness license, which is coming out next year for the National Football Association here. I'm a head of rehab at FC Bravo, which is a first division football team here in Slovenia, and also training people privately, several of the national team players, and then doing quite a bit of consulting and mentoring these days. So yeah, in a nutshell. And last but not least, I'm a dad to a four-year-old, which probably takes up most of my time. But yeah, you know how that is.
I know exactly how that is. And man, you killed my first two questions there, because I was going to ask what's new. But, you know, yeah, like you said, we got like the FC Bravo stuff going. Seems like everything is good on your end right now, man.
It's been a transition after 4 years of working with as like head S&C and just head of everything. Olympia, which is kind of known as the top club in Slovenia. I was working with the academy, so under 19s, under 17s. I'll actually love that. But it was pretty much spending every single day on the pitch as well. Again, with pros and cons, we get a lot of insight into injury, load management, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's weekends, it's a lot of time away from family. And after 4 years, I just decided to switch over, and then had quite a few invitations, but I grabbed one that I thought was a best fit. So I'm embedded with the team. So the guys will come into the gym. I do the strength work with them as well, but I'll see the injured players on a day-to-day basis. And yeah, it's great for building rapport and an insight into the other side, maybe health performance continuums. Yeah, I'm learning stuff every day as well, Mike. I mean, I don't have the set return to play protocols, because every injury is different, every person is different, and you've got certain heuristics that you use, but I'll just treat everyone as an individual. And sometimes it'll take, you get a hammy and it's a week, and same presentation, another guy, it'll be like 3 months. So yeah, it's very complex.
For sure. That actually leads right into our first line of questioning here, because something that I know you and I are both passionate about is this return to play, return to sport continuum and process. And one of the things that we also share as well is that we've seen this both in the private setting, like in our gym, but we've also seen it in a club setting working for another team. So I'd love to hear from you. What are your experiences in those two environments, and how is it different working maybe in a private setting versus working for a club?
It's a really good question. I think there'll be a lot of practitioners out there who will identify with this. And I think the first thing you have to identify is your role, right? Okay, what am I supposed to do here in this organization, be it privately? So if you're a private practitioner who's working with someone as an outsourced rehab specialist or a S&C, I think the most important thing is transparency. You need to let the stakeholders know what kind of load the players are under. So what you did, what you intend to do, and how that fits into the bigger picture of that. It's obviously different when you've got someone who's sent out to you on a long-term like ACL rehab. That's different, right? But in my world, obviously when I was working privately, it was, and still is, right? It's day to day, week to week. So we need to get loads, data, GPS data from the club. I'm obviously a big advocate of just talking to the player. How do you feel? Getting subjective data from them as well. But mostly privately, you've just got much more time. And there are obviously financial time constraints. Someone will pay you to work one-on-one, and I'll be able to go out there on the pitch. I'll be able to do like biomechanics, sprint speed stuff, record everything, give them feedback. Then you move into the semi-private area. You can't really do that. Sure. So you're basically, I mean, you're concentrated on the things that you can change. So in the gym, right? So maybe power strength stuff. And then when you're in a club, you're, at least when I was there, and obviously I'll give some context here. We're not talking about Premier League level here, where you've got like 20 people who are each doing their own thing, and you can, and next door to you is the data analyst. You can go and talk to him and get the data. The other side of you is your medical team, and you're like, okay, can you give me this manual intervention? No, you're doing everything, right? Doing everything. You're doing the manual stuff. You're doing the load management. You're doing the data analysis. You're doing everything. And sometimes you might be like, you're working with one player, and then sometimes you've got like a slew of injuries. You've played 6 games over the last 2 weeks, and there's 10 people there in the treatment room or in the mini gym that you have. Now, these clubs, they don't have force plates. The gym is very limited to what you can do. So what are you going to do? So I think it's very important to have the toolkit for these different scenarios. And again, I always try to at least have one objective data marker and something subjective that I work off. Mm-hmm. And obviously, when I'm in the private setting, I can have the force plates. I've got my VBT and other stuff that I can use. But then when I'm in a different environment, then I've got to have something different. But these days, we've got smartphones and we've got apps that can help us do that. So I try to combine those both. But I would come back to identifying what your role is, and especially when taking on a new role, sitting down with the decision makers, be it that the first team coach or even higher up, managing director or sports director. All right, who do I report to? What are my responsibilities? What is my authority? So what can I decide on? Right. Obviously, I prefer to work as a team, even when I'm working privately, to consult with people and then make a decision based on the player's best interests.
Yeah. I love the idea of doing your best to define roles and just knowing, again, if you're working in an NBA team or an English Premier level team, they've got 15, 20 people, right? And they have team meetings that just revolve around, okay, player A, what do we need to do for them today? And medical's going to chime in, and the soft tissue person. Everybody has their little angle and role, and hopefully they're doing a good job communicating. But in spaces like ours, generally you're taking 4 or 5 jobs on, right? So like, we have a guy that's coming through our gym right now, and there's Bill or Eric. So we've got like a PT and like more of a medical side. We've got me taking care of the S&C side. Now, luckily this guy has a little bit of disposable income and he's got some soft tissue stuff. So we've referred him out to get some soft tissue work done. But man, in these kinds of environments, you have to take on more than just one role. And you also have to be skilled in a lot of different things. And that's where it's the communication process. And keep in mind, this doesn't happen overnight. Start as like an S&C coach and kind of work your way out. But just having a better understanding of all the various stakeholders and how you can help them without overstepping, I think is very important. And that's something we always try and espouse. If we're doing return to play is, okay, what is Bill and Eric's job? What do they need to do? What is my job? What is Jenny, our soft tissue person? What are all of our jobs? And then how can we help each other so we're all kind of congruent in our approach versus working against each other?
I would add something here. It's like also building a data set, and you and I'm pretty sure we both go, when we see a new injury or something that we haven't seen before, we'll go and look at the research and best practice and everything. But I think the most important thing, you need to know your own team and your own context, because the load that players have been exposed to in your setting might be completely different to what the, you know, best research says. So I think it's important to, over time, build your data sets, know the players that you're working with, and then build your own best practice. Obviously, there will be guidelines. And again, I like to use heuristics and that you will use. And obviously, starting with do no harm. But right. I really feel it's important to build your own data set and then work from there in terms of rehabbing players.
I love it. So one thing that we wanted to talk about during this show was decision making and using data to drive decision making. So what are maybe some of the best ways that we can use technology and data to guide our decision making? And along those same lines, how much data is enough? How much is too much? Because you and I both have access to some really cool tools, but when you first get in there, it can be overwhelming. So how do you use it? How is it valuable? And then how do you use enough so that you don't get overwhelmed or lost in the process?
Okay, so that's a great question. I'll actually come back to what I said before. So what is my role in this scenario? Okay. Because someone needs to be the gatekeeper. Now, in certain instances, I was the gatekeeper. So I have to decide which data will go through the filter. Now, so in the academy setting, I used to get the GPS data. I did some force plate analysis on a weekly basis with the players. And that was, again, my own data. And then furthermore, at the time, we didn't really have VBT data and we did subjective questionnaires. So I had the RPE data. Deciding basically, first of all, what's valid, because some of the RPE data at the time, I would say, was only valid because I went really deep into the relationship with the players. They would give me like numbers that I think most practitioners would say, you know, I don't think that was a 5, don't think that was a 7. But I tracked that over time and I knew exactly when someone gave me a 5, who would usually give me like a 3. there was something there, just opportunity to discuss things with the player and look under the hood. And then obviously I had some objective data from the force plate to back that up, and also from the GPS data. And so you've ran a whole lot. Your sprint distance is up. How are your hammies feeling and all that kind of stuff? I would say, again, depending on where you are in the chain of decision-making and communication, I think that's really important here. For myself right now, I use the force plate data. Now, in return to play, that'll be weekly or fortnightly, really. Once every 2 weeks, I'll test players. I don't like to test them too often because that way sometimes it causes anxiety in the players. They feel, because they do have the visuals, they're like, oh, am I up or am I down? And you need to give them context. So I always just give them like maybe very little feedback. And then after the session, we'll be like, look, this is what's happening. Sometimes I'll say, look, we're in a period of overload, eccentric overload. Your numbers are going to go down. Your performance is going to go down. It's supposed to go down. And just making the players feel good where they're at in the return to play. And then, again, depending on who's on the other side of the phone, I'll share some of the data with the physios because it will maybe be meaningful to them. The head coach, I don't think he really cares about the eccentric braking impulse, but I'll try to convey that in layman's terms or something that is meaningful to him. All right, we're a bit away from him being able to decelerate 100% and then change the direction. So maybe we won't do like small-sided games yet, even when they're the floater. Yeah. Giving context, oh, how far away are we? Because I don't like to give timelines, but I'm like, okay, so this is what we're doing now. We're avoiding players coming onto us, but it's all anticipated and trying to build context to where they can come onto the pitch, play small-sided games, large-sided games, friendlies, and then so forth.
Yeah. The thing that you mentioned there early on in that was that you have multiple data sets that you're tracking, right? You're not solely relying on one. And I think that's really smart too, because now you have multiple things that you can make your decision-making off of. Because as well as I do, sometimes you just have an off day. Like one thing is just off, but everything else is going up. I always would try and like pitch that to an athlete. Look, all the trends are going in the right direction. So don't put too much stock in this one thing that might be down or a little bit off. So I think that's really important. But then like you alluded to as well, giving them this like really good rationale for if their numbers are down, hey, maybe you want them to be down at that point, right? Maybe you're chasing an adaptation that they don't have that long-term could become more preventative for them. So helping them understand the process, I think, is so valuable. And like you alluded to, you have really good relationships with your athletes. I'd like to think that I do as well. I think that's part of it, is helping educate them as to not just the training process, but in our case, the return to play process and how to come back better and hopefully stay healthy the next time they get back out there.
Definitely. And also sometimes the players will be anxious about you testing them because they'll feel, okay, they know there's something there. They're slightly injured and they'll be worried about, but I'll say, look, you're not going to be able to play. And then I'm just going to have a conversation. Look, don't worry about the numbers. We don't have to like go to the coach and say, there's no way you can play, but you know, this is me. We're trying to protect you, not just for this game, but you know, your health. We want to have you on the team for the next 10 games. We've got a really heavy congested fixture list over the next two months. Why would you want to like risk that by playing this Saturday? Because, you know, Mike, you and I both know we can't predict injury, but we can raise, I guess, some concerns in relation to some generic testing, then some more specific testing. And sometimes we'll even go out on the pitch if certain things look right, and we'll go, look, I want to see a sprint, change direction before we go into game situations. And obviously we'll build up to that. We never make a decision. So Friday, you're just doing a gym session, and then Saturday you're playing. So we're always building up and getting feedback from the skills coaches and the head coach as well before we introduce players to live games.
For sure. Okay. So I think this makes sense to talk about now. Let's talk about KPIs. Everybody likes to talk about KPIs, key performance indicators. What are some of the most important ones for you in the soccer space? And Matej, I really want to say football because I know it's football, but as soon as I start saying football, everybody here in the States is going to think American football. So I'm going to say soccer. What are the most important KPIs for you in the soccer space? And then maybe a second part to that, how do they shift or how do they change between your off-season and your in-season training periods?
All right, another good question. And I don't know if this is what people want to hear, but For me, the most important KPI is actually seeing the players play the game. And I watch all the games for our guys. I obviously can't watch all the games for all the guys that I train. Sure. But I do every weekend. I go through the statistics, how much they played. Did they score? Did they assist? I know those numbers, right? I know if they're injured. I'm on the phone. I'm on the WhatsApp getting feedback from them. Essentially, for our team, I'm looking at the game. If not 90 minutes, I'll look at, because we have an online platform where I can download and look at the specific actions and snippets of game time. And I'll look at certain people who are at risk, I guess, who've just come back from injury, have got their first minutes after quite a long time. And I'll look at that because qualitatively, that's for me the most important thing. So that the gym is secondary or even tertiary. But obviously, I need to have some numbers. And then in season, we will look at readiness stuff. So we've got our output units to measure RSI for the drop jumps. That'll give us something basically on a daily basis, how we'll adjust training. On the force plates, will you look at stuff like time to peak power, eccentric braking impulse, velocity of takeoff. So those are some of the parameters I'll look at from the force plates. And then I always look at relative motion, something I guess that Bill and yourself instilled in me as well. Yeah. But, you know, for me, I know each player when they walk in the door, I know because I've tested them pre-season and I'm during the season, I'll have a bandwidth. Some guys have like literally 5 degrees internal rotation. And I'm like, look, we need to address this before we go onto any other performance elements or measures. So I'm looking at performance measures, but I'm definitely looking at health measures, if you want to call them that, because I think as soon as we give them a little bit more space, be it external or internal rotation, we've just got more bandwidth to display the performance that we want to see them. And then off season, I'm obviously not looking at them on the pitch. So in that scenario, what I'm really big in these days is deceleration, tracking their deceleration numbers. So RFD, we're also doing a curvilinear sprint and braking test during the off season, along with obviously force plate data. So early on in the off season, I'm focusing more on the deceleration braking part. So I'll look at the eccentric duration, braking duration or contraction times, how big they are, how much force can they essentially withstand within that time frame. And yep, we're looking to obviously shorten that and increase the force. And then over time, we'll look at more concentric measures. Some of those I alluded to just before. And we're always tracking the relative motion. So for me, for the football soccer players, it's always hips, man. It's all in the hips. So ER, yeah, IR, and hip extension is huge for them.
For sure. When you talk about your braking stuff, what are you looking at there? Like drop landings? What are your go-tos?
So we've got different things, right? So yes, and I actually thought the episode with Matt that you had,
yeah,
he's more from the basketball,
sharp dude.
I really love that. So I probably echo some of the stuff that he would say in terms of the force plate numbers, but I like to give a horizontal component. So we're doing obviously progressing 10 meter, 20 meter, 30 meter sprints with maximum decel, obviously building up to those. But so yep, I want to see basically how long they need, or in terms of distance and time to stop, and then obviously change direction. Damien Harper's a leading researcher in this space, and I've gone through a lot of his work and I use a lot of his stuff, and I'm starting to implement laser guns now because it's just much easier to get a valid measure of how quickly players decelerate and brake. So I think that's huge for off-season work. And then on top of that, then obviously building the speed stuff, acceleration, and then max speed.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Damien Harper's on the wish list to get on the show. So if somebody listens to this that knows him, give him a shout out. Say I'd love to bring him on because I'm fascinated by that as well. I have not dug as much into that, but it's definitely something I want to add to the testing battery.
Whoops, I had one more thing, Mike, because I know we're talking like a lot of the measures which are obviously associated with numbers, but I'm really huge on quality. So I film pretty much every single rep when we do like accelerations, decelerations, and max speed stuff. I film it because I'm not Dan Paff, even though I've, you know, been mentored by him. But I need to slow things down and look at what am I seeing. So that penultimate braking step deceleration, I'm definitely looking at that, especially in the returns. gives us a lot of clues at how, you know, guarding that injured leg. And, yes. It's obviously, you know, if you look at it on the force plate, it might show up, but it's just different because you're using single leg stuff, you're using bilateral stuff, but it's got pretty much a vertical displacement component, whereby when you're forcing someone to go like into a maximum braking phase during 10 meter or 20 meter acceleration and then deceleration, they're gonna guard their what they feel is at risk, and you get a lot of insight with qualitative data, i.e. video.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's funny. Lee Taft told me the same thing at one point. I was like, Lee, dude, how do you like see all this stuff? He's Mike, I still record stuff. I don't see everything. I still use my phone. I was like, oh, okay, there's my permission slip. And I started videoing a lot more, and it definitely made me faster. One other thing while we're on this topic, because I think this is fascinating. You talked about like the penultimate step when we're talking about braking. One of the things that I have found when we do use force plates, right? Again, we're chasing and looking at different things, vertical versus horizontal. But one of the things that I found, we talked about this before the show, is that a lot of times this stuff doesn't come out in, say, a squat jump or maybe even a CMJ. But when you start doing like a rebound CMJ, where they have to do things multiple times for max intent, that's when some of this stuff starts to show up. And that's where you start to see these asymmetries. So I feel like a lot of times you just have to dig deeper. Everybody wants the easy answer, but sometimes you just got to dig a couple layers deeper to really figure out, okay, is this person really feeling confident in this injured limb or not?
I just had one thing on that because it was interesting. I just had like rebound, single leg counter movement, like rebound jumps with a couple of players the other week. And I think what's important here is that you understand how competent the player is or the athlete is with the actual test. Because sometimes the first time they do that test, I'm not really looking that much into the numbers because they're absolutely shocking when they go into the single leg rebound, right? Yeah. I actually had a couple of people falling off the plates and just like, all right, we're shutting it down, giving you some extra reps before you actually take the test. But I think it's important to understand how competent an athlete is with a certain test before you can interpret the data.
Sure. I love it. Okay. So I think the KPIs are obviously important. But it's like a starting point. If we're being honest, this is a starting point. Now, how do we use those KPIs to drive better programming? Because I think that's where the rubber really meets the road. If you're enjoying today's podcast and not already subscribed to the Robertson Training Systems newsletter, what are you waiting for? When you sign up, you'll get immediate access to materials that will help you write better programs, motivate people outside of the gym, and improve how your clients move and feel. Plus, the RTS newsletter is the only place where I announce up-and-coming events like virtual summits, live seminars, and my program design mentorship. And last but not least, I hate spam as much as you do, so I will only email you when I've got something valuable to deliver, something that will make you a better athlete, trainer, or coach. So if you're not already subscribed, head over to robertsontrainingsystems.com and register for our newsletter right now, today. Now, that's enough for me. Let's get back into this week's episode.
Again, now depending whether we're talking off season or in season, but during the in season, we've got to remember football, soccer is a culture that doesn't like to get in the gym too much. In my world, I've been able to get them into the gym like twice a week, which I think is
great,
a result pretty much. And then we're usually focusing on like just longer contraction times. It'll be quasi max effort on a match day plus three normally in the gym. We'll use a lot of holding ISOs in that scenario. We're talking at team level because stuff that's easy to implement for when you're training like 20 people. Obviously, when you're doing one-on-ones, semi-private stuff, then it's easier to, we're doing stuff on the Exafly and other modalities as well. But we definitely have something that resembles like a quasi-max effort day and then a dynamic effort day. And then it will really depend on some of the measures that we get for the daily readiness for the respective players, how much we want to push it. And to be honest, look, Mike, during the season, we're microdosing pretty much everything because we can't really afford to go too hard in the gym, get them sore, and then they don't perform on the pitch. We might be able to go after certain adaptations with some bench players for sure. And obviously with people who we're bringing back from injury, we can actually get them better at certain things. But yeah, no, most of the time in season, we're just microdosing. And off season, again, usually it's a 3-day split where we're going max effort, dynamic effort, repetition effort, and we're just basically repeating that because, and I brought this up in the presentation for the IFASTU, but you know, my reality is that the off season here in Europe for soccer is 4 to 6 weeks max, right? That's crazy. What you have available. So how are you going to periodize that? I go into so-called sprint blocks, like 2 to 3 weeks where I'd go, pretty much eccentric or deceleration first 2 or 3 weeks or early foot contacts if you want, then yep. Kind of max propulsion phase and then late propulsion and then acceleration. So that's the way. And then I try to recycle that during the season, really, to be honest.
Yeah.
So that way I'm making sure that the player is robust enough to withstand all of the elements that everything that's being thrown against them, because obviously soccer is a sport where you can't just focus on top speed and then you switch the brakes off. So I'm just recycling that during the course of the season, really, to be honest.
It's so hard. And in your world, like, I've been lucky. The shortest off season I had ever was like 3.5, 4 weeks because a guy played in the MLS Cup and then got called into January camp. So he had legitimately 3.5 weeks. He's okay. What do I do? Oh, we're going to have to do a little bit of everything because as soon as he finished January camp, he had to report to his team's training camp. But I think that's important to note when you have those kinds of situations as well, is that your only goal is to try and set them up so they have a healthy preseason. And sometimes people are like, how do we get them ready for, no, you're thinking too far ahead. And especially one thing that I do love about soccer, at least in my experience, people are very good about building things up in a sequential fashion. So your only goal in that preseason is to get them ready for training camp. And then in training camp, you might practice 3 weeks and then you have a friendly where you play 45 minutes and then, you know, over the course of the next 3 weeks, then you build up to 90 minutes. But even still, I know you've seen this, at like to get to peak fitness level in soccer, you need 4 to 6 weeks of high level competition before you ever get there. So now you got to think it's like a 12-week process to get all the way up to match fitness. You don't have to be there day one of preseason or training camp.
Look, I'm looking at stuff that I can really impact in 4 to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking, okay, what is the stuff that I won't be able to do during the season?
Yes.
So
yes.
If you look, take that into account, I'm going to go heavy on the eccentric overload. I'm going to go heavy, obviously, progressively on the plyos. Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
I'm going to try to get a little bit of max strength with indicated lifts, obviously. I'm not going to crush them and compress the shit out of them. And that's pretty much it. I'm trying to bring them, even during the off season, getting them outside to work on the mechanics, even if it's not maximum effort.
Yeah.
That is acceleration with dragon sleds, max velocity. We're looking at posture. We're looking at foot contacts and then change of direction and deceleration. That's what we're looking at. Quantitatively in the gym and then what can we also do qualitatively on the pitch before it all goes haywire? Because once you're in camp, I mean, you're playing soccer all the time. And then during the season, like I said, it's pretty much a top up thing in terms of, and microdosing in terms of these qualities.
Yeah, I love it. Okay. What tech excites you in the future and why?
Well, first of all, I sometimes get overwhelmed with tech because I was actually an early adopter and now I'm not anymore. So I actually had, you still remember the push bands?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I think I got them now. I might tell a lie, but I think it was like 2008, 2010. I'm not sure when they started. It was in their first year. I went straight to the Toronto headquarters. I think there was two guys there at the time working and I bought three sets of those push bands off. Like, great. This is going to be, it's going to open up my world. And I got some buy-in from the players. It was great. But then I'll never forget a session, put the bands on them. I actually programmed the session on the app and the Bluetooth's not working. And then I'm like, and they're like, what are we doing? And then after 10 minutes, I'm like, guys, get the straps off. We're going 5 sets of 3 push presses, whatever, with max intent. And why I say that is because I think it's important to have the tech validated first for people to get exposed to this and do some research as well. Does it work? Is it valid? Is it reliable? But these days we've got a wealth of information, and a couple of things that really excites me is, so the biomechanical app, so ViewMotion is, I think, an Australian company, and they have teamed up with Altis and Speedworks in the UK. I'm using some of that because it's incredible what it spits out. I mean, you go, you set up some cones, you go into either acceleration, max velocity, or change of direction, and you'll get a report back. You'll get your step rate, step frequency, stride length. I mean, it's amazing. And you can actually take those things and go into the gym and focus on that, impact that, and you will get a change. I truly believe that. And another company, it's called Plantiga. I think Matt Jordan's actually a founder, or at least involved in some sort. I think, and I've already spoken to them, and maybe for Christmas someone will get me a pair of Plantigas. But I think it's really exciting because it's live information on your foot contacts, on your, again, stride length, stride frequency, how much force you're putting into the ground. It's really exciting stuff. But again, I would come back to, okay, what is the data? But then do I have someone to interpret the data for me? Or can I interpret the data? Can I act meaningfully with that data to improve their stride length or how they change direction? I think that's very important. But I think this space is something to look out for. And we're getting older, but I think we're going to have to keep up with the tech if we want to basically serve our players best.
Yeah, that's something I really try and espouse. I don't think it's hard with the younger generation. I think just tech is baked into their lifestyle. They've had phones and iPads and all kinds of cool gizmos since they were little. But yeah, coaches our age, if you're in your late 30s, early 40s, maybe you're not as open-minded about this stuff. Look, if you're going to be in this game for 20, 30 years, it's only going to get bigger, broader. There's only going to be more tech. So at some point, I think you just need to dive in and get comfortable with it. Never, maybe it's never like your main thing, but it's like any other related field, right? Like, I'm never going to be Bill Hartman when it comes to physical therapy, but I need to know enough about it to where he and I can have good conversations. Same thing with the sports tech side. Like, if you're not at least somewhat comfortable with the space, what they're doing, the information they're trying to pull, I think you're leaving yourself at a disadvantage.
I would say I'll definitely agree with that. But again, there's a caveat to that. So I go into some gyms these days. These are like young-ish practitioners. I would say very technically proficient.
Yes.
And they've got their VBT set up. They've got their force plate set up. They're trying to track everything. And I just feel like it just slows the session down so much. There's no, they're spitting out numbers all the time. And what's missing is AI. And I don't mean artificial intelligence. I mean actual interaction. Okay.
Yeah.
So speaking to the players, how did that feel? Okay. Well, how are you going to take that into the game or into training? And I've seen it in my sessions. I've tried to implement, we'll start with the output for the daily readiness, which is great because I get subjective to RP data, wellness data on the spot, and I'll have a conversation. And then we'll do the RSIs, the drop to jumps. And then we'll go on to the force plates. And I'm 30 minutes into the session, Mike, and people are standing around and waiting for me. Obviously, look, it's a logistics thing. I could have an intern help me out and everything.
Sure.
But I need to have that time, that moment after I do something to have a conversation with a player, because that minute or 2 minutes is going to be huge when I'm reporting to the head coach or when they come back from the gym, because I build trust, and trust is basically the biggest currency there is in this game, I feel.
Yeah. No, I love that, man. Okay. Switching gears a little bit. I got a couple off the board questions that I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on. Number one, talk to me about the role of the consultant strength and conditioning coach.
All right. So again, I think context matters here. There are great practitioners who basically live as consultants once they give their life to the game, I guess. I would say someone like Martin Buschaik, you know, who's been in high level of academia and also embedded in teams like for 15 years. Now he can go on and consult. And I think that's great. I think for us mere mortals, though, it will be consulting the teams and organizations who can't, and I don't want to say afford, because it's not just financially, to have you there on a daily basis. I think it's actually, like, in terms of logistics, bringing you in when they need you to improve and optimize their training or recovery or rehab process, and then basically getting you back in for an audit every, I don't know, at a certain frequency, right?
Sure.
I feel that's definitely going to happen in, at least in my space, where teams are underfunded. We don't have teams with millions of euros or dollars on a budget, and they may have a junior S&C who's just out of college or may know his way around, but then can't interpret data, doesn't, you know how to start with the rehab protocols, doesn't know how to get the most out of his 15 minutes of the pre-training routine. In our world, we're talking like resets, readiness, how to individualize that part of training. And you can step in, and it's a very win-win situation where you help out the club and the practitioners and come back every now and then to review. And also, we're talking about, we're past 40 now. We're not getting any younger. And I feel, obviously, you and me, we had a conversation about this prior to going on air. We probably want to stay on the floor. We probably want to stay on the pitch because that's our passion. But I'm pretty sure you don't want to spend 10 hours a day on the gym floor coaching anymore. And I think, Phil, obviously, you need to build up to that. You need to deserve that. You need to pay your dues. But at a certain point, when you've got the experience, and also you're trying to add value to people. And I think the consultant role is something that will definitely, it'll be increasing, I'll say, at the mid-range and also at the high and the low range as well of clubs talking about. The top clubs will always look for that 1%. They'll get the top guys in who they feel can make the difference. But we could make a lot of difference with clubs that don't have $1 million or euro budgets. And I feel even the work I've done so far with some of the clubs have got really good feedback, and I don't have to be there every single day, but I can give them feedback either in person or online.
You just gave me this brilliant idea. And if you are a private business owner, you might want to take a hold of this, because I can just imagine where this would be really valuable. So obviously, most of the times when you hear about, oh, performance consultant, we're thinking, again, like NBA, MLS, Premier League, NFL, Major League Baseball, huge high-level consultants going into these big clubs, and that's cool. But again, for the rest of the world, maybe if you have a second or third division soccer team or whatever, lower-level sports, or what I have a ton of here, and I don't know if it's quite the same overseas, but there are tons of youth sports, right? Where they're starting to implement S&C, right? Maybe they want just like a preseason injury screening for kids. It goes beyond just the physical, right? Or the medical side, but they want a little bit of testing done. That could be a really cool way to infuse yourself into what they're doing, positively impact some kids. Because a lot of times, from what I've seen with these types of programs, they just get one program. If there's like a headquarters sends down one program for all the U14 soccer players or baseball players, now maybe we can have some discussions like, hey, these are the things we're seeing. Maybe we could change some things or tweak some things and ultimately make a really positive impact on the clubs and the teams that we're associated with.
Yeah, and we want to be educators as well, right? I mean, because we're working in this space where we have parents coming in and they're pretty much telling us what we need to do with the kids, right, in terms of physical development. And then on the other hand, working a lot with the agents as well. Again, they've got their own view of timelines of development and all that kind of stuff. And I feel we need to be really cognizant of the fact that we're one of our primary roles is educators. When we're talking especially about young people, right? So I think this consultant slash educator piece would be very valuable and important in the time to come for, again, the organizations and clubs and entities that, you know, don't have massive budgets to work with.
Yeah. I love that, man. Okay, so last one, then we'll start to wrap up here. And this is totally off topic, but I think it's also important. As you've alluded to, we are both getting older, and it is very much, I think, a young person's game. Fitness in general is really, there's a lot of like social media influence and 20 and 30 year olds showing abs and hundreds of thousands of TikTok or Instagram viewers. So I'm interested in your thoughts on this, and I have some as well, but how can we make sure that we as coaches, we're relevant, we're financially secure, we stay healthy and happy in this profession as we age?
I think you just said it there, Mike. I mean, there's obviously several layers to this, but we need to take care of ourselves first, right? We need to stay healthy. And like the amount of coaches, and I'm not talking just in sports, but just private coaches, like personal trainers, who just knock themselves out with the amount of work they do and also training, I guess. Yeah. And I can see them like in their late 20s, early 30s, they're already burning out. And I don't want to be one of those people. So obviously for me, I like to I've set myself a standard. And what I like to see is when I'm coaching, when I'm demonstrating exercises, so I want to be able to demonstrate and coach live, not just by cueing, but actually doing as well.
Yeah.
For some time to come. So that's definitely important. And how can I achieve that? Well, by training it regularly myself, making sure that I'm walking the talk, basically, that I'm tracking my own data, which I actually am more cognizant of some of these, you know, variables that we look for, you know, HRV, and sleep data and all the type of stuff without obviously being overwhelmed. You know, slowly kind of, I think for me, at least, I don't know about you, it's happens quite organically because switching from mainly on the floor, on the pitch now to providing more education and mentorship because people have sought me out. I don't know. I think they've seen me do it more often than not live because I don't have a massive social media presence. They've sought me out and now I think I can deliver other things to them as well. So I think finding a good balance of, so speaking, you definitely need to have a side gig in this business. I love what I do, but I think without a certain amount of income from either writing, presenting, building some type of or designing some type of online product, it's going to be difficult to maintain the level of income and financial freedom for ourselves in the long term, right? So we need to just look at, I guess, what our toolkit is, where we're best at. Like I already alluded to, I'm more comfortable with in-person things than I am social media. So I don't know if I'll go down the route of designing loads of online products, or although I've actually broken the ice there and I've done a little bit, but most yeah. probably it'll be more like speaking, mentoring, and consulting in person.
Yeah. And I think that's where, just as we get older, we all need a vision for, I don't believe in like the 20-year timeline or game plan anymore. That's not really, it's not really possible, but at least having like a general outline. Okay. I've obviously thought about, okay, 20 years down the line, I'm not somebody that's just going to be able to shut this off and not think about training anymore because I'm retired or whatever. So what does it look like? Do I want to be on the floor as much as I am now? Probably not. But how can I, like you alluded to, stay relevant and continue to make some money and mentor the next generation of coaches? So I think that's where, regardless of where you're at in this, whether you're 25, 45, 65, like start to think about if you are going to be in this game for 20 plus years, how are you going to evolve? How are you going to continue to grow so that you can stay relevant and continue to just get better, right? Get better as a coach and do things that make an impact on the world.
For sure. And you know, part of it is obviously continuing to educate ourselves and building the toolkit. And then I like to think that nowadays I like to go a little bit beyond the S&C, the fitness world, to look at other sciences and see what I can bring in, into my practice to enhance my delivery of content, of things to basically motivate general pop clients and also athletes to basically do what they need to do, what I know they need to do to stay healthy and successful in the long term.
Yeah, I love it. Okay. Have there been any big shifts or changes to your philosophy over the past 1 to 2 years?
I'd say it's usually a gradual shift when I think about, when I think back about these things, but I've definitely moved to, when we talk about gym-based stuff, I think I'm definitely not focused on strength. And again, we've got several definitions of strength, but
yeah.
I really think for the population that I work with, football, soccer players, it's something that I have to up and obviously have certain levels of strength, but I've definitely gone more towards the agility coordination side of things lately. I think looking back now, I used it a lot anyway, but at a fascial based approach, training athletes based on their needs. Most of the guys I will see are fascially driven athletes. And I know some people don't like that phrase, but it's the springy athletes who just won't respond well to maximal strength loads.
Yeah.
I think that, just basically using every single client and athlete as an experiment and just building their case study and working on their injury history and performance history and to build out programs for them where they're at right now. And thankfully, I've got some really good data now. I've been working with some of the national team soccer players like 12 years now. So I think that's a really good data set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just interesting because certain terms get very buzzworthy, right? Like you hear a lot of people talking about fascially driven athletes and, you can say whatever you want about not liking it, but look, we bucketed people into more like springy, elastic versus force-based creatures for a long time now, a long time. So just because you don't like a certain term, that's okay. Like, you don't have to agree. Some people don't like Bill using wides versus narrow ISAs. It doesn't matter. As long as we have the same general framework and representation that we're speaking from, not everybody's going to agree on language or terminology, and that's okay. But by and large, we have to have an understanding of, look, certain athletes are built for the weight room, right? Certain athletes are built for that fascial, elastic, just bouncy, reactive type of work. And just knowing, okay, these are their superpowers. And then how do we plug the gaps, so to speak, or how do we fill in those gaps so that we can keep them healthy and performing at a high level? But I'm with you, man. The internet loves to make a big deal out of nothing when it comes to S&C.
I'd say on that, I'd say two things. So one thing is it's got to be meaningful to them. And then the second yeah. thing is, can we give them what they need? Or are we just yeah. a strength coach who will just put a barbell on their back no matter what? All right. Like you said, I've got three or four buckets that I usually place athletes in. All right. Can I give you what you need? And will you be able to perform on the pitch? It's going to be evident, right? Pretty much. So
yeah.
Over the long term, I think after 10 years, you can say whether you've been successful with an athlete or not. And obviously, look, we're a small part of the puzzle.
Sure.
But I think we are an important stakeholder nonetheless.
Agreed. Okay. Last but not least, we got our lightning round, my friend. Five fairly short questions. Your answer can be as long or short as you like. Number one, arguably the most important to me, what's your current go-to coffee spot in Ljubljana?
Oh, I actually just a couple of months ago, I switched to a new place called Specialka. So the special one, really. So special to coffee. Okay. It's in a redeveloped old like bike factory. So yeah, it's good times. But you know, I do my rounds, Mike. I don't like to switch anyone off. And yeah, you've got some up and coming specialty coffee place for sure. So I've always got something going on. But yeah, that's the new one.
Okay, I love it. Number two, what's your favorite book that you've read in the past year?
That's a tough one. I've been reading and rereading some of the Alan Watts stuff. So I would say I've actually reread Behave as well. And yeah, I'd probably say Behave. It's actually somewhere around here.
Yeah.
I would say Behave.
Babe. Okay. Number three, you mentioned this briefly. Talk to me about your recent contribution to IFASTU. Shameless plug here, people. Matej, what did you talk about?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I was honored to be asked. Thanks again for that, for the opportunity. But yeah, I was talking about what we essentially covered briefly over the course of our talk. So basically how to organize training for specifically for off-season for soccer players when you've got such time constraints as we have, talking 4 to 6 weeks, basically how to organize the training and what kind of elements to focus on, given that you can't just throw everything at them. You're looking at specific adaptations, right? So just broken it down to coincide with the gait cycle, which I've kind of taken partly from Bill's work. Working quite a bit with Jan Katanitz as well. And yeah, they've been influential over the last couple of years in that space. And then, yeah, from what I've seen, it's been working. Players are healthy and performing well. Yeah, get on that. I think it was a decent prezo.
Yeah.
And I think people will look at that and say, okay, that's maybe something different. Maybe I want to try that given what I've got, the time constraints that I have.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant way to organize. I think it's a brilliant way to organize an off season. And again, based on the short duration of time, you're trying to get this really focal adaptation in each of those little windows. Granted, I'm biased because I think you and I are pretty similar in our approach at this point. But yeah, again, shameless plug, $47. You can get not only access to Matej's presentation, but all of the current IFASTU presentations. So check that out. Number four, serious question. Any tips for helping Luca chill out the next time I see him? How can we ramp him down?
I don't know. Just give him something to smoke, man. No, just kidding. He has switched from Monster to coffee. So,
congrats
on that front. Yeah, he's doing. He has taken that step. He's bitten that bullet. Kudos to him. I think, yeah, I've treated him to a couple of float tanks before.
Oh, yeah, those are huge.
That would be a good one. Man, peace of mind is a sought-after commodity in that human. I think, I don't know, I don't want him to slow down, even though I do. But, you know, he's going to have to find that tempo adaptation himself. Yeah, I mean, what he's doing, by the way, is nothing short of amazing, the way he grinds through and all the content and value he delivers to people. So, yeah, hats off to him.
Agreed. The last time we were there, me, him, Joel, and Ariel went to this place called the Hot House. So next time we're in Seattle, I've heard great things about Banya. Never been to Banya, the Russian bathhouse. The Hot House is amazing. Literally, there's like a hot tub. There's a dry sauna, a wet sauna, like a cold shower. So you can cycle through the three. Man, most relaxed I've been in quite some time. Highly recommend if you're ever in Seattle. And I don't get promoted. Oh, definitely. I don't get any money for that, but the Hot House was pretty nice. Okay. Cool. Last but not least, man, what's next for Matej Hosovar, man? What are you working on? What are you excited about? Anything?
Okay. So this is something that we didn't speak about before, but it's actually more like diving into the health side of our industry, because I've got a project that will look into some training adaptations for people with Parkinson's disease. Everyone's aware, but both of my parents have Parkinson's. And so it's something that hits close to home. And I decided to do some research and trying to get some people who are suffering from the disease and trying to prove, which I think I'll be able to, that with specific exercise interventions, specific strength training, and particularly aerobic adaptations will help their symptoms. So I'm trying to partner up with some companies that do embedded EMG and some brain imaging, which will basically provide us with on dopamine levels, which is like a KPI for Parkinson's disease. So apart from obviously the stuff that I've got going on with the soccer, that's something that I'm passionate about going into the second part of the year this year and looking for some partners in that space. I've got some very exciting meetings coming up. And so that's something to look out for. Other than that, you've got quite a few requests for consulting, mentoring, both domestically from within Slovenia, and also we've been invited, or we're talking about whether we'll come to them or they'll come to us, but, you know, trainers, coaches from different European countries. So that's exciting as well.
That's cool.
To get recognition from people who are looking at you from afar and have recognized the value that they feel we provide. So I'm looking forward to that. And I guess just obviously, definitely last but not least, I'm probably going to just get that one shot at being a dad. So I don't want to let that one fly. And just trying to give the time and attention that I feel the little human deserves. So just trying to be present there on a daily basis. And
I love it, man. Especially at four, dude. Enjoy the snuggles. Snuggles aren't there forever, man. I still get a few from Cade, but man, he's 10. I'm worried. Once those are gone, I don't know what I'm going to do. My wife's going to be annoyed. I'm just going to want to cling to her all the time.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it's a pretty golden period right now. I'm trying to kind of stay cognizant of that. And then, just trying to cherish it. And also trying to spend time with the family whenever I can. Yeah.
I love it, man. I love it. Dude, so much respect for you, what you're doing. You are one of my best friends in this industry, and I just appreciate you on so many levels. So with that being said, Matej, where can my listeners find out more about you and all the great work you're doing?
First of all, appreciate you, Mike, right back at you, man. I mean, you've been hugely influential on my career and my development. Without you, much of this wouldn't be possible. So thank you as well. But socials, I guess I'm decently active on Instagram. I am on Twitter, but I'm pretty much behind the scenes there. I actually try to be more active there, but you can find me on Instagram and then our website, but I think Instagram is probably the place to go to see what I've got going on.
Perfect.
And obviously iFastU from my now,
and iFastU, I'll make sure I put all of those in the show notes. iFastU is actually going to sponsor this episode, so a couple shameless plugs in here. But Matej, again, this was amazing, man. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you again.
All right, my friends, that does it for this week's episode with Matej. Really hope you enjoyed it. He is just such a wealth of knowledge. Every time he and I chat, I feel like I'm thinking a little bit differently about my process. I'm trying to get a little bit better, whether it's with my return to play protocols, whether it's with the way I write training programs. So really, really hope you enjoyed this episode. There's so much to take away. It's definitely one you're going to want to listen to a couple times. And as well, if you work with anybody that's in the soccer space, or maybe like us, a little bit more on the, you know, long in the tooth side in this game, pass this along to them, because I think it's going to help give them a little bit of insight. It's going to give them a little bit of motivation to continue to keep growing and evolving so that they can stay in this SNC game for as long as they'd like. So my friend, if you enjoyed this episode, please do me one small favor. Wherever you consume podcasts, the big three right now, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Podcasts, go there right now and hit the subscribe, follow button, whatever they're calling it these days, so you know each and every week when a new episode drops. So my friend, as always, thank you so much for your support. Love and appreciate you, and we'll be back next week with our next episode. Take care.